everyone, and welcome back to Murder, Mother and Me, where each week we will dive into some of the most infamous murders, mysteries and everything in between.
So if, like us, you are intrigued by all things true crime, you're in the right place.
I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm your other host, Patty. I'm the mother.
And I'm the me.
As always, thank you for all the support so far on our podcast.
Please don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Murder, Mother and Me Podcast. Share with your friends and write us a review.
But only if it's a good one.
So this week we're going to be talking about a really current case, which is actually in the headlines at the moment, which we've never done before. So it's interesting for us to talk about something that's still ongoing. And I know, Mum, you've been literally obsessed with it since you started reading about it.
I've been binging this. Well, it just came on one day and then one thing led to another. So I was intrigued by it, really, because it's, although there's a lot of crime goes on, I just think the nature of this one is exceptional, really, because of the circumstances and who it involves.
And when my mum gets obsessed with something, it's no exaggeration to say that she has it on the telly literally 24/7. So if anyone knows anything about this case, it's Patty.
Because it's been going on for a couple of years and it was going to trial and then it wasn't going to trial, I think everyone was expecting it to come up, so there was a lot on about it at the time leading up to it. And then it never happened. So there's so much material on it and information on it. And new things come out every day because they're now releasing all the documentation that was acquired along the way. So we're learning more and more about it.
Right, everyone. With that being said, let's get on with this week's episode. And this is the horrific case of the Idaho Four. There's a town that on the surface seems quiet, safe. A place where college students walk home under the glow of streetlights, friends laugh in late-night bars, and families live ordinary lives. But sometimes, darkness arrives where you least expect it. November 13th, 2022, began like any other night in Moscow, Idaho. But by dawn, four young lives, bright, full of promise, would be brutally stolen. Their deaths would shatter a community, haunt a campus, and leave investigators scrambling for answers that seemed impossible to find. Who could commit such a crime? Why? And how did it happen in a house just steps away from people who could have stopped it? Before we go any further, let's go right back to the beginning. There are towns in America that feel immune to darkness. Towns where the pace of life is slow, where community runs deep, where people convince themselves it could never happen here. Moscow, Idaho is one of those places. Set against the Palouse, rolling hills of golden wheat and farmland stretching in every direction, Moscow is a picturesque college town. Home to just over 25,000 people, it's the kind of place where students know their baristas by name, where professors wave across town to their students, where the community and the university blend into one. At the heart of it all is the University of Idaho, a campus filled with historic brick buildings, tree-lined walkways, and a sense of tradition. Students spill out of lecture halls during the day, crowd into coffee shops in the evenings, and walk home beneath the glow of old-fashioned street lamps at night. For years, Moscow was described as safe, peaceful, the kind of place where you left your front door unlocked, where neighbours looked out for one another, where parents felt comfortable letting their children roam the quiet streets. But safety, as this story will show, is sometimes an illusion. On November 13, 2022, four young lives, full of hope, energy and future plans, were cut short in the most brutal way imaginable. Their deaths didn't just devastate their families, they rippled outward through the campus, the community and across the entire country. The murders left behind a trail of unanswered questions. Who could do this, why, and how did it happen inside a home where others were present and still survived? This is the story of what happened inside the house on King Road.
So Moscow sounds like a really nice place to live, and from what I've seen and heard, it was exactly as you've just described. It was a safe community, considered safe in this day and age, where it is a student town, so you know, students have come from all over the country to be at Idaho University. And there was, as with any university, there was sort of on-campus accommodation and off-campus, and the house on King Road was off-campus. So I think these students were coming to the end of their courses because they were slightly different ages, some were 20, some were 21, maybe nearly 22. And as what usually happens is, when students move to a university town, they'll stay on campus. You know, I'm sure their parents would prefer that because it's getting to know the town and the people, isn't it? And then they move off campus when they're a bit more confident about where they're living. And it's a bit more freedom for them, isn't it, I think. So they've moved into this house on King Road. and it was quite a big house.
And there's usually quite a, when it comes to students, there's usually quite a lot of them that share these houses, isn't there?
Well, I suppose it makes it cheaper for them. And
upwards of like 5-6 people sometimes.
I think in this house there was 5 people, 5 girls, and the house had always been used as a student house. I'm not sure going back many years, but I think it was probably built specifically for that purpose with that in mind, because it was originally 2-storey and a 3rd storey being added, as you say, because a lot of students want to share because it makes it cheaper for them, etc. So they ended up, these students who had gotten to know each other, sharing this house. And it was 5 young women on their own, basically.
And you've just said there was a 3rd floor added, which also is important to remember. And what's also important to remember is, from what I've heard about this case and read about it and seen the floor plans and stuff, the layout of this house was not like a normal house. It was a bit of a maze inside, so you'd really have to have been inside or at least scoped it out from a close distance to know the layout of where to go. Multiple people on multiple interviews that I've heard said it's not somewhere you just walk in and know your way around the layout like you would potentially in a normal house.
No, and this comes into play later on, doesn't it? Because this crime happened in the early hours of the morning, so it would have been dark. So for somebody to actually navigate that house, they would have to... In the dark, they'd have to have some kind of familiarity with it, you know, in some respect. But it was a bit of a sort of mishmash of rooms going backwards and forwards with staircases and things. So it was complicated even in the daylight, I think. But the top floor had been added on to make it more spacious, and obviously it suited these students. It was a bit of a I don't like to say party house, because I think they were just being normal students, but they were very social and a lot of people would go in and out of this house. At times, there were people going in and out the house when the actual residents, the students who were living there themselves, weren't present. So it was kind of free and easy, really. I think because it was such a safe town and it was mainly students and stuff that they were associating with. So, you know, it was kind of like an open house, really.
Well, I think in this day and age, if you're leaving your doors unlocked, you must feel pretty safe to be able to do that. And I think that was a common theme across the campus and off campus, you know, residents. They didn't care about leaving their doors unlocked because it really did feel like a safe, you know, neighbourhood to live in. And I think this is a crime that no one ever expected to happen in somewhere like Moscow and had never happened before in Moscow. I think the biggest bit of crime they had there was like someone's car got stolen or, you know, maybe minor things. But as far as I have heard and listened to, this is the biggest thing that's ever happened in this town.
And as we'll come to find out later on in the story, the drawers were left unlocked. I mean, the other thing is as well, it was built into a sort of a hillside, so there was woodland, a small woodland area behind, but there were other houses in close proximity, so the person who did the crime took, I think, still a big chance, because, you know, obviously with CCTV cameras and things being what they are today, somebody had one on their house. But the houses were literally, it was a neighborhood and they were quite close together, really. But there was this area behind that if somebody wanted to observe the house or watch the house, stalk the house, some kind of peeping Tom situation, they could actually see into the house when the lights were on. And I think with them being young, when you're young, you feel invincible. You don't really think about things like that. And this,
I don't think anyone thinks about that.
Well, I do, because I pull all the blinds down, lock all the doors and check 15 times before
I go anywhere.
That's
because you're a true crime nerd.
Exactly. But at that age, you know, you wouldn't think, oh, is someone going to be looking in at me? But that, again, comes into play later on in the story.
When tragedies like this strike, the headlines focus on the violence, the investigation, the killer. But at the heart of the story are the lives lost, and these 4 young people were so much more than victims. Madison Maddie Mogan, 21. Maddie was pure energy. Born in Coeur d'Alene, she had a magnetic personality, the kind of girl who remembered the little things about everyone. Friends say she had an old soul wrapped in a fun, loving spirit. She'd sing at concerts, dance in kitchens, and pull her friends into wild adventures. She was inseparable from Kaylee Gonsalves, best friends since middle school, sisters in everything but blood. Maddie was studying marketing, determined to carve out her path in business, but she also had a lightheartedness that made her unforgettable. Kaylee Gonsalves, 21. Kaylee grew up in Rathdrum, Idaho, in a large and fiercely close family. She was bold, outspoken, and ready to take on the world. Her family called her the firecracker, smart, driven, unafraid of challenges. She'd recently landed a coveted tech job in Austin, Texas, and had just purchased her first car, a Range Rover, a sign of how hard she worked for independence. That weekend, Kaylee had come back to Moscow only to see Maddie, a last visit before her new life began. She brought with her a bride and joy, a puppy named Murphy, who was by her side constantly. Zanna Knodel, 20. Zanna grew up in Post Falls, Idaho. She was witty with a sharp, sarcastic humour that made her fun to be around. Friends said she had an eye roll that could cut through you, but a heart that made you feel safe once you were close. She was juggling her marketing degree while also working, showing resilience and independence. She loved social media, loved to laugh, and she was in love with Ethan Chapin. Together, they were a natural fit, a couple who laughed constantly, who seemed meant for one another. Ethan Chapin, 20. Ethan was one of triplets, from Mount Vernon, Washington. Growing up with a brother and sister his exact age created a closeness that defined him. He was athletic, outdoorsy, fun-loving. He was the type of person who brought warmth into a room, who cracked jokes to make everyone else relax. Studying recreation and sport management, he was building a future around what he loved most: people, activity, and community. With Zanna, his easygoing spirit found a match. Also in the King Road house were Dylan Mortensen and Bethany Funk, both younger students, still new to college life. They were close with the others, part of the constant flow of friends and laughter in the house. Their survival and Dylan's account of what she saw would later become a cornerstone of the investigation.
So the five actual residents of the property were the girls. So it was Dylan, Bethany, Kaylee, Maddie and Zanna. But Ethan, being Zanna's boyfriend, would come over and stay quite often, so he was also there the night of the crime.
And if I'm not wrong, Kaylee actually didn't live there at the time of the murder. She was just back, like I just said, visiting Maddie to kind of say goodbye before what seemed to be the start of a new job, and to show off her new car, and she brought a dog with her, and it just seemed like they were having a bit of a catch-up. I think that makes it even more sad than it already is.
It makes it sad, doesn't it? Because she shouldn't have actually...
She wasn't even supposed to be there.
It was just fate, wasn't it, that she happened to be there that night, I think.
And by all accounts of all of the victims, they just seem like young, fun-loving students that are living the best uni life.
Well, they'd not gone far from home, most of them, had they? So they were all kind of lived around Idaho previous to that. So they were kind of hometown girls and boys, weren't they? So they'd gone for somewhere reasonably close, I suppose, where their parents could, you know, still see them a lot and things. And they'd worked very hard, and some of them had got to the end. They were in different stages of their education. And then, you know, as you say, Kaylee came back to see them because she'd worked and got a first car and everything, and that's what happened that night.
The night of November 13th, 2022. The Saturday night began with laughter, alcohol and friendship. Maddie and Kaylee spent the night downtown. At the Corner Club bar, they mingled with friends, smiling, chatting. Later, at 1:40 a.m, they appeared on the Grub Truck's live stream, waiting for their pasta carbonara, laughing as they spoke with people nearby. At 1:56 a.m, they caught a ride home, climbing into the warmth of the King Road house. Ethan and Zanna were at a Sigma Chi party down the street. They spent the evening together, seen dancing and chatting with friends. They left the fraternity house around 1:45 a.m. and walked the short distance back to the King Road house. Dylan and Bethany had already returned home earlier that night. Their bedrooms, one on the ground floor, one on the second floor, were quiet by the time the others came home. By 2 a.m, all six residents were inside. Lights dimmed, music and laughter faded. Moscow outside was falling into silence, but someone else was still awake. 4 a.m, Zanna received a DoorDash order, which she picked up at the front door. Forensic evidence, the food bag found on her nightstand, confirmed she ate moments before the attack. She was also active on TikTok around 4 a.m, scrolling and watching videos. Upstairs, Kaylee and Maddie were restless. They made repeated calls to Kaylee's ex-boyfriend Jack. 7 times Kaylee dialed, 3 times Maddie tried. None of the calls were answered. The killer was already outside. Surveillance video later showed a white Hyundai Elantra circling the neighbourhood, passing the house multiple times, then returning. 4:12 a.m. Dylan, asleep on the second floor, was startled awake. She thought she heard Kaylee playing with their dog Murphy. Then came something else. The sound of a voice. Quiet, but unmistakable. There's someone here.
So it was just a normal night for them, wasn't it? Because they partied and socialised quite a lot, so they'd all been out. Well, a few of them had been out anyway and come home. And this is like early hours of the morning, isn't it? So they probably chatted for a while and do what everyone does, you know, when it's you go to bed sometimes, you get your phone out, don't you, and scroll through your phone. And I think one of them was watching Vampire Diaries or something. And I think it was Bethany that had toothache or something, and she'd taken Advil or something and gone to bed, you know, some kind of painkiller.
Probably knocked her out.
Yeah, she was a bit drowsy and probably slept through nearly all of it, I think.
And I mean,
didn't know what was going on at all till it all became clear what had happened.
It says Maddie and Kaylee were trying to call an ex-boyfriend, and who's answering the phone at 4 o'clock in the morning?
Well, they're the same age, aren't they? So
maybe he was out as well. Yeah,
or something. I mean, yeah. I think Kaylee's ex-boyfriend, he was still on good terms because they actually got that dog together, I believe, and she'd ended up with the dog. So I don't think there was anything they were phoning for any other reason except maybe for
They were probably just a bit drunk as well because they'd been out drinking
probably,
all night.
Yeah, and then because they'd been friends from such an early age, from when they were about 11, they used to sleep sometimes in the same bed. So they ended up in Maddie's room. I mean, Kaylee wasn't actually living there, but her room was still there, empty. But they ended up in Maddie's room, in the bed there. And it was only a small room. I've seen pictures. The bed was pushed up against the wall.
Yeah, I seen an interview with Kaylee's mum, and she said basically the bed was the room.
It
almost went from wall to wall.
I was surprised when I saw it because I'd heard the account of what they believe it happened. And then when I actually saw the pictures, I thought, good God, if you were in that bed...
Couldn't even swing a cat
people,
in there, could you?
If there was two people in that bed and an attacker came in, they would come in the door and all it would be the bed and them standing in the doorway,
There's no room to move anywhere.
You wouldn't even be able to get out. So you're trapped in that very small space with somebody with, as it turned out, a huge hunting knife.
And imagine being Dylan and waking up, being startled awake. I mean, you know what it's like when you're a bang or something and you startle yourself awake and you're kind of unsure, did I just hear a bang? Did it happen? Did it not? But then imagine hearing someone saying, there's someone here. Now, in that first instance of you being still half asleep, are you going to think that's like, there's someone here, like, shit, there's something going down? Or are you maybe going to just think, like, oh, there's someone here, you know what I mean?
I think because it was such a busy house, because people were coming and going at
that's
different
what I
times,
mean.
To hear noises at, like, 4 a.m. or 3 a.m. or whatever wouldn't be unusual. And there's a dog in the house, and they were getting up and down to let the dog out for a week because he was only a puppy, so they were still kind of training him, I think. And I think the girls probably had turns during that. So if you heard someone coming down the stairs, I'm sure there was a lot of, like, traffic up and down the stairs, you know, at all kinds of hours in the house. They were up watching TV, they were up on the phones, they were doing all the normal things that students and young people do.
And I think the sentence, there's someone here, like, I think it really depends how it was said in terms of what situation that means they're in. You know what I mean? It could be like, oh, there's someone here, as in, like, there's someone downstairs, like, they've just come in. Like, it could be one of their friends from uni or something as well. But obviously, as this turns out, it wasn't in that sense. So basically, when she's hearing someone say, there's someone here, I don't think even she knows who it was that she heard say that or who she could hear outside of her room at that point.
I think there's some confusion as to whether she heard Kaylee. I think it was probably maybe Kaylee. I don't know, because it definitely started with the top floor, didn't it? So the attacker came in through an open sliding door that was like a patio door type thing, through the kitchen, I think, and it was the back of the house. So they came in through that door and made their way up to the third floor, which might tell us something about the motive to this crime eventually. And so the other girls were underneath, so there was only Maddie and Kaylee on the top floor at that point. So whatever Dylan heard, it could have been the very first attack, which was on Kaylee and Maddie. So she heard some kind of footsteps on the stairs. Sounded to me like, from what she was saying, that it was like somebody panicking and running. And then she heard crying in the bathroom, which was where Kaylee's bathroom would be. But it could very well have been the second attack, which was on Sana and Ethan. So it could have been her, because she does not really know without seeing who it was.
Because at this point, she's still in her bedroom and she's still got her door shut. So she's just going off sound alone. She hasn't seen anything at this point.
And I think she was probably half asleep and didn't really know what was going on.
That's what I'm saying. When you're startled awake, I think you start questioning everything, don't you? 4:15 to 4:20 a.m. What happened inside during those minutes is pieced together from autopsy reports, blood evidence, and Dylan's testimony. Kaylee and Maddie on the third floor were likely attacked while asleep in the same bed in Maddie's room. Forensic pathologists determined that Kaylee suffered the most severe injuries. Deep, multiple stab wounds to the chest, some so forceful they caused extensive internal damage. The coroner later described her wounds as significantly more brutal, suggesting she may have been the killer's primary target. Maddie, beside her, was also stabbed multiple times, including defensive wounds on her arms, signs she awoke and tried to fight back. The knife was a large, fixed-blade combat knife, capable of inflicting wide, fatal wounds with each strike. Blood pooled across the bedding, soaking into the mattress and seeping onto the floor below.
So from what I understand, when the killer came into the room, Maddie was on the outside and Kaylee was on the inside. And I think the attack started with Maddie. And then obviously she may have started waking up, but then that would have woke Kaylee up as well. And just over the last few weeks, the autopsy reports have come out. And
I mean, even those details that I've just said there are not even half of what them poor girls went through.
So imagine being asleep and you're not expecting this at all. You wake up and there's somebody obviously immediately attacking you. And he used a knife that was used in the military, which was called a K-bar knife, which is about a 5-inch blade, I think it is, which is pretty big. The thing about it is it's a very sturdy knife, so it's not just a thin blade.
It's been manufactured to cause as much damage as possible, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think it's used to sort of, obviously, rip through skin and bone and tissue and everything like that. And the injuries that have come out since have been that they were stabbed through the liver, stabbed through the heart. And it's so sad because when you see the families talking about it, they're learned of these findings as everybody else is as well. They weren't even told maybe prior to, maybe a little bit before. And it turns out that Kaylee was actually in an upright position. She'd obviously been trying to sit up in bed while the attacker was stabbing with this knife, and he stabbed it in the face. She tried to fight back, because obviously if he attacked Maddie first, then she's awake. She's got
a bit of a chance to wake up. Yeah,
slightly bit more of warning. And he punched her in the face and broke her nose, and punched her in the face and smashed all her teeth at the front, and stabbed her in the face. And as she was trying to get up, stabbed her downwards into the head, which is just horrific. Imagine that being somebody, a family member, your daughter especially, and knowing that she was asleep in bed and someone did that, and her face was unrecognisable. And when the first police officer arrived on the scene and he said there's two female victims on the top floor, and he said, you know, there's deep lacerations, but he couldn't recognise her.
Yeah, I read something online that said it was almost like it looked like she'd been tortured to the point of, yeah, disfiguration and being unrecognisable. Now, we have our own theories, don't we, as to why we think that occurred, which we'll get into a bit later. But I think just the nature of this is just so horrific that, imagine, because I'm imagining these girls are not even awake at the point of the start of the attack. I think that initial blow of the knife is what wakes you up, which is, it's not like they've heard footsteps and they've woke up and they've kind of had a chance to get their bearings and figure out potentially what's going on. They're being woken up by a knife being driven into their body. Yeah. Or at least Maddie is, which is then obviously causing her to move and probably scream, which is then waking Kaylee up, and then he's focused his attention on her. Because I would imagine these don't look like, you know, they're quite small females. I think one stab wound's putting you down. Therefore, he's obviously dealt with Maddie quickly, and when Kaylee's woke up, he doesn't need to worry about Maddie anymore because he's already inflicted enough damage on her that she's not really going to be a threat to him. So then he's focused all his attention on Kaylee. And obviously, he's done a lot more to Kaylee than he has to Maddie for whatever reason.
It sounds a bit like he was angry, doesn't it? That, you know, we'll go into this later on, but the fact that she's woken up and maybe fighting back.
He didn't like that, did he?
He's used more force, hasn't he? Yeah, and it's very personal, this, isn't it? Because he's using his fists and he's using a knife.
And we're not just talking about, like, a couple of stab wounds here and there in this whole attack. This is an absolute frenzy, an all-out attack. It's upwards of 50 stab wounds in some of the victims. It's not just, you know, he's come in and he's basically almost executed them, like he slit their throat or something, and dealt with them quickly. This is an ongoing, brutal attack that seems never-ending.
It's a frenzied attack, isn't it? And you've got to remember as well, and we'll get to the perpetrator later on, but this is a man and he's like 6 foot tall and he's over these two girls in the bed. And if someone's standing over you like that, how are you supposed to get away anyway, or even get up? So they were incapacitated right away, and they were at a disadvantage right away.
They didn't really stand a chance, did they?
And they were females, and I don't care what anyone says, they're not as strong as males, are they? So right away, there wasn't much chance of them surviving this, was there?
The killer then moved downstairs and encountered Zanna. Her body was found in the doorway of her room. She had defensive wounds, deep cuts across her hands and forearms from trying to grab the blade. She also suffered multiple stab wounds to her torso and neck. Blood evidence showed signs of a struggle. Overturned items, spatter patterns indicating movement. Zanna remained alive for some minutes after the attack. Her last activity on TikTok around 4:12 a.m. may have been moments before the killer entered. It is then believed the killer ended the life of Ethan Chapin. His autopsy revealed multiple stab wounds, primarily to the torso, delivered with tremendous force. Some wounds punctured vital organs, causing rapid blood loss. Ethan's body was discovered on Zanna's bed, and his blood was said to have seeped out of the side of the house in the hours before his body was discovered. So, from what I understand, there's actually multiple different accounts of what they believe happened with this encounter and with Zanna and Ethan, and obviously because no one was there to witness it, it's kind of a bit of a guessing game when they're just going off blood spatter analysis and where the bodies were positioned and stuff as to what they believe happened.
I think it's obvious really that just by the timeline, you know, because as they were saying, Zanna was on TikTok, what was it, 4:12,
yeah,
something like that. That killer entered the house sometime between 4 o'clock and left at some round about 20 past or something like that, wasn't it? In that short space of time, he managed to kill four people. He went up to the top floor and then came down to the second floor. And whether they were intended victims or whether it was just by chance he encountered Zanna, it sounds to me like she was up and awake because she'd had a food delivery, a DoorDash delivery, which is just like, you know, when you, what's those things on?
It's like Uber Eats, isn't it? Delivery.
Yeah, something like that. And she'd taken it into a room. Now, did she then hear a commotion? Because he was probably in the house by then upstairs.
I think he definitely was.
And then she's maybe eating her food, like, you know, just before that. Probably just missed him going up the stairs. And then heard something maybe and went out to see. And he has been coming down the stairs as she's come out of the doorway, maybe, or opened the door, and he's seen her. And then she's just kind of been...
Collateral damage?
Yeah.
I think it's exactly that. I think she's probably heard something, whether that's heavy footsteps or someone screaming or someone crying, and she's probably thought, what's going on? So she's come out, and just by chance, it's been a case of really bad timing. She's come out at the exact moment that he's coming down the stairs. Bear in mind, he had a balaclava on. So he's coming down these stairs with balaclava on, gloves on, a big hunting knife, and she's came out to meet this in the middle of a hallway outside of her bedroom.
And considering the kind of house they lived in, you know, people coming and going, as I say, wasn't unusual, but to see somebody decked from head to toe in that kind of gear coming in is not something you would normally expect, is it? So imagine being confronted with that, you know.
It must have been terrifying.
He sees her and probably instinctually just attacks her, and then she's fighting back, you know, because she had over 50 stab wounds, didn't she?
Yeah, this is the one that I was saying earlier, that there was over 50 stab wounds, and it was Zanna, unfortunately. So,
and a lot of them were defense wounds, so they'd be on her arms and on her hands, and there was a really deep cut between her first finger and her thumb.
So she's obviously
right
tried to grab
tendons.
That knife as
she's
he's swinging for her.
She's tried to grab the knife, yeah.
And I can only imagine, like we said earlier, this isn't just like a methodical attack. He is in an absolute frenzy at this point. He's just murdered the two girls on the top floor. He's come down the stairs for what I can only imagine is to leave through those sliding doors again. And he's encountered this girl and he's still in that frenzy. His adrenaline's pumping. He's not thinking rationally at this point. He's just thinking, she's now saw me. She's going to have to go as well. And that's it. I think if there was five people in that hallway that he's seeing, he probably would have tried to kill them all in the mental state that he was in at that moment.
And she was awake. She wasn't asleep. So obviously the first thing you're going to do is fight back, isn't it? And her boyfriend, I think, was asleep in the bed because they'd been out. They'd been drinking. She'd been eating her food and she wasn't expecting any of this. And he's just gone asleep. And I think he was unaware of what was going on. Now, whether he woke up at some point, I don't know.
It sounds to me like he didn't ever wake up. It sounds to me that from what I've read and what I've heard, he was essentially just put down.
I think the fact that he's got so many stab wounds to his torso indicates maybe that he was lying down, and he's gone over to the bed and he's just thought, to be sure, I'm just going to... He wants to incapacitate him, doesn't he? What if he was to wake up? You know,
well, I was
going to
say,
male,
let's be honest, Ethan is not a small guy, is he? So I think if he was to wake up and put up a fight, we might be having a different conversation right
and
now.
And he's a sports major, isn't he? So he's going to be fit and, you know...
And he's tall, and I think I think the killer would have known that if he hadn't have dealt with him in that moment while he's asleep, which is, you know... It's cowardly, that, isn't it?
I was just going to say, this killer's a coward, isn't he? Because he preys on women, and when confronted with somebody of his own size or somebody that could possibly overpower him, he's going to annihilate that threat before it becomes a threat. But to do that to somebody while they're asleep, that poor lad was just...
I would go as far as saying I don't think Ethan ever known that anything was even going on.
Well, I hope he didn't. And he would have come to Zana's defence, wouldn't he, obviously?
4:17 a.m. Dylan opened the door again. She heard crying, likely Zana's, followed by a male voice saying, "It's okay, I'm going to help you." The voice was calm, controlled. When Dylan opened the door once more, she saw him. A tall man, dressed in black, wearing a mask that covered his nose and mouth. His eyes were visible above it, framed by thick, bushy eyebrows. She froze in shock as he walked past her. He didn't run, he didn't rush. He moved with eerie calmness, slipping out through the sliding glass door on the second floor. Now, again, I've heard a lot of things about this, and she's under the impression that he actually didn't see her peeking through her door. Because I believe that if he would have seen her and confronted her face to face, she would also be one of these victims as well.
I don't know, you know, because I've heard it two different ways. She did see him and he did see it. She said he made eye contact with her, that he looked directly at her but just carried on going past, and she was 3 feet away from him when she opened the door, which is that's as close as we are now, even closer.
So then my only question in that scenario would be, why did he confront Zana in such a brutal way and kill her, but he didn't do the same with Dylan? I can't make sense of that.
Well, again, the experts have spoken about this, so they've all got different theories, you know. Was he in some kind of catatonic state by this time? Had he fulfilled what he wanted to do and he didn't have the energy to do anymore?
I was just going to say, I did hear an expert talking about it, and they were saying that amount of adrenaline coursing through your body, it has to run out at some point. And by this point, possibly, he's killed 4 human beings at this point. He might have been completely depleted of all energy.
Yeah.
And just think, I need to get out now.
He might have been in, and this isn't in no way excusing it, I don't mean it in that way, but under some kind of spell, if you like, and it's now broken, and he's just wants to go, kind of thing. But she said he looked directly at her, and that's how she got such a good look at him, really. And then she slammed the door shut and locked the door.
I mean, it's hard, and I'm not in any way saying that this is anything against Dylan, but she has given slightly different accounts along the way of what's happened, and I think that's causing a lot of confusion in the case as to, did he see her? Did he not see her? I've even seen things saying, you know, this bushy eyebrows thing was such a massive thing about identifying eventually who the killer was. But I've also heard multiple things saying that she never said he had bushy eyebrows, or she did say that he had bushy eyebrows.
In every account I've seen, she said she did say that. And I think she gave a really good... You see her getting interviewed on the body cam footage of the first policeman that turned up. And actually, that policeman was only not much older. I think he was in his early 20s. And he was really good with them, I think, the way he handled the situation. And she says on that right away that he has bushy eyebrows, and she says that he was taller than her, and she's 5'10", so that would make him round about 6'4", 5'11", 6'4". And he was athletically built, but she said not like big built, but more like maybe like a basketball player or something like that. And she got it spot on. That's exactly what he turned
out to
be.
Well, I don't think there's any question that she saw him. We know for sure that she definitely saw him, but whether he made eye contact with her or seen her or whatever...
She said that he made... I've seen the police interview with her when they... Not the initial one there, but afterwards they get interviewed in the police station, and she says that he... Came out somewhere that she made eye contact with him. I think that's why she was so afraid.
Well, I mean, I'm not even saying that, you know, it's bad that she's given different accounts. It's understandable in the scenario that she's in. And I believe she was in and out of sleep this whole time. So, you know, like I said earlier, you know what it's like when you're a bit dazed from sleep and stuff. You don't know, did things actually happen? Is that exactly how it happened? You're probably questioning yourself.
I think you've got to account as well for the level of shock she'd be in. you know, you wake up the next morning and your friends have all been murdered, and you realise at that point that you've seen the killer, obviously, and you could have been a victim. And it's still in your head what you've seen, but then everything else is coming in, all the things, and you're starting to try and make sense of it all. So
also, while all this was happening and Dylan was in and out of sleep and she'd seen this, I think she was also questioning, was this real? Had she even seen anyone at all? Had she even heard the noises, or was this like some kind of dream? And she began texting Kaylee upstairs saying, Kaylee, what's going on? And she wasn't getting any response. So then she was texting Bethany, who was on the ground floor.
She was texting Maddie as well.
She was pretty much texting everyone saying, guys, what's going on? And then she texts Bethany downstairs saying, I'm freaking out. Something's going on. And Bethany was a bit like, oh, shut up. Nothing's going on. She was like, come to my room downstairs. So then Dylan ran downstairs to their room. And whatever's happened there, they've had a little conversation. And they've decided to both go to sleep. And then obviously the next morning they've woke up and Dylan started thinking, well, no, something's definitely happened. I'm sure of it.
I think it was because she said when she got up, a lot of the roommates were normally up between sort of around 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock and no one was getting up. So they tried calling them again and no one was answering again.
And that's when they probably knew that something was really wrong.
They knew that something had happened and called some of their friends who weren't living in that house. They were somewhere else, and brought one of the friends brought their boyfriend around, and he came in and looked.
And obviously was not expecting to find what he found.
And you see him on the body cam footage, don't you? And I think his name's Hunter, and he was really calm. I mean, you can see he was a bit shaken up, but he handled it really well because he wouldn't let them go upstairs or anything.
He told them that one of them was unconscious inside, didn't he? And in fact, that was the first 911 call saying that there's an unconscious roommate. So even police had turned up at this scene. Never in a million years expecting to find what they found because of what he'd said. And I think he'd done that to spare the horror of everyone seeing what was inside.
He did. He was quite sensible, wasn't he? But when the police
went in... quite brave, that really, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean, to see that, you know, and he says on the body cam footage that he tried to, I think, I don't know whether he checked the girl, which it turned out to be Zanna, I think, was the first one he came to. But he'd not checked Ethan at that point, and he said he couldn't find a pulse, or something like that it was. So now at this point, you know, they're realising something is horribly wrong, and what she'd seen the night before was definitely real.
Within 20 minutes, four young lives were gone. Kaylee, brutal chest wounds, likely the killer's focus. Maddie, multiple stab wounds, fought back. Ethan, killed quickly but violently. And Zanna, defensive wounds, prolonged struggle, stabbed multiple times before succumbing to her injuries. The killer left behind a single critical piece of evidence, a tan leather knife sheath, found on Maddie's bed near her and Kaylee. On the button snap, a single male DNA profile. The hours after were chillingly ordinary outside the house. The sun rose, students went to brunch, life moved on. But inside the King Road home, the bodies of four students lay undiscovered. It wasn't until 11:58 a.m. that a call was placed to 911. It was reported as an unconscious female. When police arrived, what they found was far, far worse. A massacre that would haunt them for the rest of their careers. The King Road house, once full of life, music and laughter, was now silent. A crime scene soaked in grief. The murders sent shockwaves through Moscow. A small town suddenly became the centre of national headlines. Students were terrified. Parents pulled their kids out of university. Rumours spread about stalkers, serial killers and random attacks. But amid the panic, investigators quietly began piecing together the truth. A white car, a cell phone gone dark, a strand of DNA. And soon, they would zero in on an unlikely suspect. A man who studied crime for a living, but who may have been incapable of resisting his darkest impulses. That brings us to the end of part one of the Idaho 4 case, and in episode two, we will discuss the investigation, the suspect, and the road to justice. I always find it hard doing two-part episodes, because I want to say his name when we're talking about the killer and the suspect.
Yeah, it's hard, because we know who he is.
Well, and I think most people, if you've not heard about this case, you must have been living under a rock, because it's literally been everywhere, so most people listening will probably know who we're already talking about, but yeah, this case is just... We're only halfway through it as well.
I think the nature of the crime, as I said before, you know, because there were young people, there was four of them, and and the person who committed the crime, I think it was quite surprising, really, wasn't it? I think the two girls that survived, I think that was kind of a miracle, really, because I think they just, if they'd been in the wrong place at the wrong time, like a split second, you know, a minute here or there, it would have been a different story.
I think they were very lucky, in a way, to have been in the rooms they were in at the time
they were in there, yeah, and the time that she opened the door and she didn't open the door and so forth. But the fact that she actually opened the door after seeing this and ran to her friend's room just amazes me, because
I know.
I don't think I would have come out.
No, and I think a lot of speculation has been online about these two surviving roommates and why did they survive and why are the stories changing
But more importantly, why it took them so long to phone for help.
Well, I think that was the biggest point, wasn't it, from, you know, online sleuths and stuff like that and true crime fans, is why did they wait, was it 12 hours or something?
It was 8 hours, I think. It was like 4 o'clock in the morning.
It's a considerable amount of time, isn't it?
By the time they even phoned someone to come and help, it probably would have been round about even 11, 11:30, and then it was 12 when it was reported to the emergency services. I think when Dylan ran out of the room to her friend's room, you know, it's like safety in numbers kind of thing. I suppose she took a chance, really, after she'd seen the murderer walk out. She said he was going towards the sliding glass doors, so whether she saw him leave or not, I'm not sure, but she obviously felt a little bit safer to run to her friend's room. But how could you actually sleep after that and then just go to sleep and just...
Well, I'm under the impression that all of the students in this house have been drinking in one capacity or another, whether they'd all been to the same party or different places or whatever. So I'm under the impression, from what I've heard, that Dylan and Bethany had also been drinking in some capacity.
I don't know whether Bethany was, because she's had this toothache and her father's,
or at least
a dentist.
Dylan.
And but then if your friend told you that there was a masked intruder in the house, what you'd seen, and your friends weren't answering the phone... For your own safety's sake, would you not phone? And I'm not blaming them, by the way. I'm not saying that, because who knows what you would do under these circumstances.
No, that's what I'm saying.
All they're both only very young, aren't they,
this speculation online is neither here nor there, I think, because no one's been in that situation. You never know how you're going to react in that. Like I said multiple times about Dylan, she's probably questioning if that's even what she's seen at all. And,
maybe.
You know, maybe her friend Bethany's half asleep as well, and she's like, oh, shut up, you're just imagining it. You know what I mean? It's probably one of them, they're just playing it off.
I just think the key for me, though, is that when your friends don't answer the phone, I would find that really suspicious.
And especially when it gets to, like, 11, 11:30 the following day, and you still haven't heard from them, when usually it's quite a lively house. You know, I mean, that is the moment that they called 911, but I don't know. I don't think there's much weight in the fact that it took them that long to ring 911, to be honest.
I'm not blaming the girls, because... None of this is their fault.
I don't think anyone's to blame other than the killer.
Exactly. And they were young, weren't they, as well, you know? And as you say, the drinking had been involved and a lot of different things. And maybe she just tried to block it out and just kind of thinking, I just want to go to sleep. And just...
Or just, like, convince herself it can't have been that I've saw, because that's too... It's too scary to think of that it can't be real.
And I think when she ran to her friend's room, when Dylan ran to Bethany's room, she said she saw Zanet in the doorway and she was lying in, I think she had it in her underwear with like a shirt on or something. She probably did think, oh, she's just passed out drunk, because they're probably used to doing this.
I was
going to
say, they've probably seen multiple people lying on the floor asleep, and, you know, fall asleep in all kinds of places.
To me, that would be like, what, you know,
what's going on?
Here, it would be like, yeah, what's going on? But for them, it was probably a usual occurrence, I'm going to say. So, and also I read something about that the crimes were committed sometimes between 4 and 4.17 or 4.20, whatever it was. But they actually timed two ways how it could have been done. And in one scenario, it would have taken 4 minutes, round about 4 minutes. And in the other one, it could actually have been done in 2-point-something minutes. And when you think, even if it was 4 minutes, 4 minutes of absolute mayhem and murder and four lives... We're taking in those 4 minutes.
But that's what brings it back to me, for the fact that he was in an absolute frenzy. He's gone up to that third floor. He's dealt with them very, very quickly. His adrenaline's pumping. He's probably gone down them stairs actually to just run and leave to leave that property. And he's encountered Zanna. And he's just dealt with her really quickly as well. Then he's gone in, seen Ethan, dealt with him as well. See you later. I'm out of there. Like, I think with the adrenaline going through his body and the amount of... He's probably also scared as well in that moment, because he doesn't know what's going on.
It was a chain of events, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That I think he wasn't expecting to happen. And we both sort of share the same theory on this, which other people do as well, which shall we talk about that next time? Yeah. But, you know, it was like one thing led to another, basically, that maybe wasn't even supposed to happen.
I think there was a lot of surprises in this situation for him as well, which he wasn't expecting, which he hadn't, you know...
Allowed for
in his plan. Right, everyone, that's it for part one of the Idaho student murders.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next time.
And remember, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime.